Hello and welcome to the Starting and Operating a Successful Permaculture Nursery Summit brought to you by the Permaculture Institute of North America, or PINA. If you support permaculture across the North American continent, then please consider becoming a PINA member today at pina.in. Today's summit is brought to you by PINA members and for PINA members and the broader permaculture community. I'm Jesse, and I'll be your host for today's summit. Our next presenter is the magnanimous Ben Caesar, presenting on the topic of perennial vegetables and how to encourage their greater adaptation. Ben is the founder of Fiddlehead Nursery, established his business in 2012 after a journey rooted in permaculture and forest gardening. Starting with transforming his small urban yard in Guelph, Ontario, into an edible perennial garden, Ben then moved to Beaver Valley in 2011 to expand his vision. At Fiddlehead, he grows all the plants he sells, focusing on hardy perennials suited to his challenging USDA Zone 5 climate. Ben's farming practices emphasize sustainability, avoiding chemicals in favor of compost, nitrogen-fixing plants, and perennial ground covers to maintain soil health. He also fosters a learning environment by hosting woofers, international farm workers who exchange labor for education, and cultivating a community passionate about sustainable farming and gardening. Welcome, Ben. Great to have you here.
Thanks very much. I don't think anybody's ever called me magnanimous before.
I was having fun with those adjectives for everybody.
Nice.
So I've been starting with the same question, actually two questions that I ask everybody, just because they tend to yield interesting results, and then I'll let you get on to your presentation and the topic. But the first one is, how has permaculture impacted your life, would you say?
Hugely. I wasn't into permaculture until I was around 27, and I moved to Guelph and met a guy who invited me to come and plant a field of nut trees with him. And he told me about permaculture, and it changed my life. I was really taken with the concept. He lent me some books. I started experimenting with, I wasn't a gardener before then. And then I started experimenting in my yard, planted a couple fruit trees. I had a pretty small yard, so I could only, I think I planted three fruit trees and a bunch of berry bushes, and then wanted to fill in the understory with a bunch of perennial vegetables that I'd been reading about, but I had a real hard time locating a lot of these plants. So that is what spurred the idea of a plant nursery. I thought here's a niche that I could exploit, and it would give me an excuse to track down a whole bunch of weird and wonderful perennial vegetables. And then I was fortunate enough to be able to get myself a farm. I haven't looked back. The quality of my life is so wonderful in running a nursery, and I encourage anybody who's thinking about it to just dive in, because it's a really wonderful, it allows you a wonderful quality of life.
I think that's one of the things that when I and so many people learn about permaculture and kind of get bit by the permaculture bug, it hints at this, or maybe explicitly even talks about the quality of life that is sort of like beyond what we're used to in sort of suburban, normal, sort of capitalistic culture. And it's something that draws us in. But then sometimes we're like, well, wait, how do I make permaculture my livelihood? How do I live a permaculture life? I already have this other job and all this other sort of like preset conditions almost. So with that in mind, with that little caveat, why would you say, and you kind of already mentioned this, but maybe go a little bit deeper, what about the nursery business might be like a really good fit for somebody just getting excited about permaculture? Well, how might it be a beneficial sort of livelihood or path for folks to go down?
Well, one thing is that you can do it on a really small scale. You can do it on any scale. So, it's a great hobby, and then you can make a little extra money on the side, or you can sort of expand as you're able to. And you really don't need much room to start a nursery. Like, you can do it with a really small yard. You can do it in a driveway, really.
Love that.
So there's a lot of possibilities for people running small scale nurseries and then scaling them up, or just keeping it at a hobby level. There's every kind of scale is available to people. And I don't make a lot of money with my nursery. I make enough that I don't have to work during the growing season, but I still work all winter at a full-time job. So I don't make my entire living through the nursery, but I'm also subsidizing my life through the produce that I grow. And I have a pretty low I don't have to pay a lot of money to live because I'm growing a lot of my own food, and I've become more and more self-sufficient as the gardens develop. So I've been lucky in that way.
Yeah. And smart in that way. You design your life in that. That's kind of the permaculture thing, is multiple streams of income, nice resiliency, and all the systems that make up your livelihood. So, well, without further ado, Ben, why don't you take it away and lead us on your presentation? I'll be here if you need me, and otherwise, take us forth, and thanks again for being here.
Okay, thanks a lot for having me, Jesse. So I'm going to talk a little bit about sort of like how to encourage people to grow perennial vegetables and to accept perennial vegetables as a concept. Yeah, it's really important, I think, in an edible forest garden to have a productive understory. And so a few things that I've done with my nursery that help to encourage people to plant and use perennial vegetables. One is I have a demonstration garden. When I first started the nursery, one of the first things I did was to plant a demonstration garden in order to show people what you can grow. So I lead tasting tours. I charge people $5 for a 15-minute tasting tour around the garden. And so I can give them samples of plants and they can taste them. A lot of people are shocked at what a diversity of different flavors and textures you can get from a perennial edible landscape. It's really fun to lead people around the garden. And an interesting aspect of that is that the tour is quite vastly different from the spring through the summer till the fall. It changes, like the products that come out of the garden is, there's a lot of shoot vegetables in the spring and then leafy greens throughout the summer, and then more fruit and nuts develop as the season winds down. Yeah, I do workshops, as Jesse mentioned, on designing forest gardens, and I also do workshops on plant propagation. So one of the things about forest gardens is that it takes a lot of plants to fill in the understory. And so if people are serious about it or want to fill in a larger area, then it really makes sense to learn how to propagate your own plants. So those are great. And then obviously in the design workshops, I talk a lot about perennial vegetables and how to use them in the kitchen. And most people have no idea what you're talking about when you mention perennial vegetables. Like, what is that? So then obviously the first answer is asparagus and rhubarb are the two most common perennial vegetables that anybody knows. And really they're the only common ones in the West, or North America at least. But then it really takes a mind shift because there are hundreds of different plants that survive the winter where I live, and that people use in different parts of the world. So it really is about shifting your mind to recognize the utility of the plants around us. So there are, another really easy bridge for people is to mention some of the ornamental plants that people already have in their gardens that are used in other parts of the world as perennial vegetables. So these are things like hostas, daylilies, sedums, Solomon's seal. These are all very common plants in the ornamental plant industry that some people have gardens full of hostas and they don't know they're edible. So I'm going to be talking more in detail about how to eat them and stuff later on. But when you mention these things and they see them in my garden, they're like, what's that doing there? This daylily, and like I have those growing in my place. And it's kind of a revelation when you say like the Chinese and the Taiwanese have, tens of thousands of acres of these under cultivation for their vegetable markets. You go to the, if you go to Japan, you'll find hosta shoots for sale in the supermarkets in the spring. So the fact that these are being very commonly used in other parts of the world demonstrates that they're economically viable and that there's a lot of utility to them. Another way of encouraging people to consider perennial vegetables is to To list the benefits, because there are multiple benefits to perennial vegetables. So one is nutrient density. There's been a lot of research in the past 10 or 15 years demonstrating the nutrient density of perennial vegetables, which are in general far higher in nutrient density than annual vegetables. And this is because they have deep, extensive root systems. You know, it takes them years to develop and to mature, but then they have like these really extensive root systems that can access minerals from the subsoils and concentrate them in their leaves. And so they're you know, higher nutrient density than annual vegetables. Another is they fill the spring hunger gap. This is key, actually. In my garden, I grow a lot of annual vegetables. I grow tomatoes and peppers and eggplants and cabbage and, you know, all the I so I'm a big fan of annual vegetables, but I have perennial vegetables popping up in my garden in March, April, May. They're like, I'm getting an abundance of food out of my garden before I'm even planting the annual vegetable garden. So there's, you know, there's a big spring hunger gap that can be filled with perennial vegetables. They're very low maintenance. Once they're established, it takes a lot of work to build any garden, but with perennial gardens, it's much easier to have a larger perennial garden and put less work into it than you know, a smaller annual vegetable garden. So if people are limited with their time or their resources, then it makes a lot of sense to either complement your annual vegetable garden with perennials or just to have to make use of your perennial vegetable gardens. A lot of things, you know, a lot of people have ornamental perennial gardens in their yards. You know, they're small patches of perennials. And there are a lot of perennial vegetables that are beautiful that work very well in ornamental gardens. So they can be incorporated into existing gardens very easily. They add diversity to both the landscape and your diet. You know, the diversity is key to resilience and health. So that's, you know, it's sort of a given. And then a lot of ground perennial vegetables act as ground covers. And ground covers are, you know, living ground covers are the key to low maintenance gardens. So I'm a huge fan of edible ground covers. And then a lot of them also attract beneficial insects. So, you know, having plants blooming throughout the growing season is really important. And a lot of those are perennial vegetables. Another way that I sort of push the perennial vegetable angle on people is that I have an Instagram account and a Facebook page. And so I'm always posting about how I use these in the kitchen. A lot of people are like, oh, okay, I can plant these in my garden, but how do I use them? It's you know, it's a big question mark for a lot of people, and there's not a whole lot of resources out there on you know, how to use all these different plants. So there's you know, I make that available to people. I don't like, you know, in this in today's environment, it's not all that kosher to, you know, to push Instagram, but if you're already on there, then it's a useful platform. And then I sell books as well through my nursery. So I sell books. There's Perennial Vegetables by Eric Tonesmeyer. I sell that. It's a fantastic. That was the first book exclusively about perennial vegetables. Eric Tonesmeyer is a fantastic author. He has a number of other books that are well worth checking out. And then Martin Crawford is a key author for me. He's a British gardener. He's the director of the Agroforestry Research Trust, and he's written a book, How to Grow Perennial Vegetables. Also, I'll mention his book, Creating a Forest Garden, is one of my Bibles. It's a fantastic book about designing forest gardens that really simplifies the process, breaks it down into a step-by-step, easy to understand process. It really eliminates the intimidation factor. So I love Martin Crawford. Look him up on YouTube. He does tours of his forest garden. Incredibly inspiring. And then another one is Stephen Barstow. He is just outside the Arctic Circle in Norway. He's written a book called Around the World in 80 Plants. Fantastic resource. He's experimented with more than 2,000 edible plants in his garden, and he chooses his 80 favorites to profile in this book. And not only does he tell you how to use them in the kitchen, how to grow them, but also how they've been used traditionally by the indigenous people all around the world. And then another sort of resource I've explored a lot is the foraging literature. And I wasn't really interested in foraging. I was interested in finding plants that would work well in the forest garden. But as soon as I started reading Samuel Thayer, he's one of the world authorities on foraging, and he inspired me to become a forager. And he covers a whole range of different plants that work really well in forest gardens. And he's just a wonderful writer who has, you know, infuses his writing with a deep philosophy about living in harmony with nature. So he's really affected me deeply. So I'm gonna start sharing my screen here. Just bear with me for a sec here. I'm gonna start little slideshow and just talk about some of my favorite perennial vegetables. I'm not going to be able to get through this whole presentation, but I'll do what I can, and happy to answer any questions towards the end. So one of the ways I encourage people to think about these is to sort of have analogs in the annual vegetable world. So there's a lot of shoot vegetables that you use, like asparagus. There are a lot of crops from perennial vegetables that give you unopened flower buds that can be used, like broccoli. And then there's obviously a whole bunch of leafy vegetables, and then some perennial tuberous vegetables that are used, like potatoes. And the leafy vegetables you can think of as using, like spinach. I use a lot of forcing buckets in my gardens in the spring for particularly the shoot vegetables. So I'm sure most of you have seen white asparagus in the supermarkets. This is called forcing asparagus. So it's not a different variety of asparagus. They've just excluded the light from the young shoots. So they either mound the shoots up with soil, and then the shoot grows up through that mound, or they use buckets to exclude the light. So this can be done with a wide range of different perennial vegetables. It's very useful. So I just use plant pots generally, and then cover the holes with duct tape, and then put a stone on top to stop the buckets from blowing away in the wind. And I cover the plants just as I see them emerging from the soil in the spring. So on the right is some blanched rhubarb that has become really popular. And this, what this does is it makes the plants more tender and mild. They reach for the sun. This is called etiolation. And so they're really tender when you cut them from under the buckets. And then generally with perennials, you can just cut them right down to the ground, and then they'll pop back up. So you can just get one harvest off each plant, but it makes them really lovely in the kitchen. So let me go into a few plant profiles here. This is cow parsnip. I sell this through my nursery. Nobody ever buys it because it has phytodermatitis. So it's if you rub the stem and get the juices on your skin, or break the stem, get the juices on your skin, and expose your skin to sunlight, it'll cause a serious burn or rash on your skin. So it removes your skin's layer of protection from the sun. So you have to be aware of this if you're growing it in your garden. But I love this plant because it's a really useful perennial vegetable. It was used by the indigenous people all across Canada and the United States. It's the young greens that you're using. It's the unopened leaves, like in the picture there, or the unopened flower buds. So it's the immature parts of the plant. They're strongly flavored. So I cook them. You can use them as tempura. They make a fantastic tempura, really a unique flavor. And then you can use them in soups and stews. It's a very highly regarded vegetable among many indigenous groups. This is related to cow parsnip, or to giant hogweed. And giant hogweed, by the way, is used in the same way in parts of China, in Asia. It's an edible plant. People are terrified of giant hogweed, but there's a lot of fear mongering going on about it. So you have to be aware of the phytodermatitis qualities of these plants, but they're well worth growing in your garden. Cut leaf coneflower. This is another really important indigenous food crop. The Cherokee name for this plant is Soshan, and that is also the Cherokee name for vegetable. So that indicates how important it was in their culture. So this is native all the way across Canada once again. This is one that forms a really good ground cover, although it's tall. It's a tall plant. When it's flowering, it's about 6 or 7 feet tall, but it's very dense. It's a misconception that ground covers need to be short. Ground covers can be quite tall. Jerusalem artichokes make a great ground cover. What ground covers do is they shade the soil, so they prevent weeds from germinating and they keep moisture in the soil. So cutleaf coneflower does this brilliantly. It does spread. It's a pretty spready plant. It'll spread underground and by seed. And so you have to be aware of that. It's more suitable for larger areas. But it's a very productive vegetable and eaten throughout the growing season until it flowers. So it has a long season of edibility. Because it's a large plant, it's producing young greens. It's the young greens that you're eating. So I like them raw. I use them in salads, but I like them even better cooked. So I put them in casseroles or soups, and then I often chop them up and throw them in eggs when I'm cooking eggs. Daylilies, again, there's thousands of acres under cultivation in parts of Asia for the daylily, the unopened flower buds. They call them golden needles. So they dry them and then reconstitute them in soups and stews. Daylilies, you can eat the flowers raw, and I often do. I throw them in salads. It's really easy to impress people by throwing daylilies in a salad. But you can only eat about five or six raw without any ill effects. If you eat 10 or 12, you'll get some serious digestive issues. So you have to cook them. But if you cook them, then you'll have no issues at all. And so I use them in tempura. I dry them for winter use. They're a very useful vegetable crop. You can also eat the shoots in the spring, as well as the tubers underground. So a really multi-purpose plant. And it's dead easy to grow because it makes a good ground cover. This is why they're so popular in the ornamental plant industry. Elderberries. These flowers are a much heralded vegetable in some parts of Europe. So every year I batter and fry elderflowers. They're a really easy to grow plant. They're big. They get to be 10 to 12 feet tall and wide, but really fantastic and very healthy flowers. And then the berries come along later. So this is just a picture of elderflowers and daylilies that I've tempura'd. Fuki is a Japanese perennial vegetable. They use the leaf stalk and the unopened flower buds in the spring. The flower buds pop up. This is flower buds popping up in March 25th, 2023. So this is the earliest perennial vegetable. Can you imagine like getting fresh food out of your garden in March? It's fantastic. So these are very bitter. It took me a long time actually to learn how to eat these and enjoy them. So the leaf stalk and the unopened flower buds, they have this like very strong bitter flavor, but as tempura, they're delicious. They're really the fatty oils really cut the bitterness and complement it beautifully. And then the stalk, it's best to boil it and then peel it and then use it in soups. And I quite like it used, somewhat sparingly in soups. So well worth growing. Goji berries are grown in Asia not only for the berries, but for the greens in the spring. So the young leaves and the stems of the leaves are a highly nutritious vegetable that is highly sought after in China, in Korea. They're very commonly grown there for both leaf production and berry production. So a great multi-purpose plant. Good King Henry is a crop of the Romans cultivated Good King Henry as kind of a perennial spinach. The young greens, you can eat them raw. They're not very good raw. I prefer to cook them when they're highly nutritious. And then these produce a really nice broccoli as well. The unopened flower buds can be used like broccoli. These make a decent ground cover. If you plant them about a foot apart, the plant itself will get to be about a foot and a half. So if you overlap the leaves, then they make a decent non-spreading ground cover. Groundnut is a North American species. It's a legume, so it fixes nitrogen, so it's improving the soil. This was an important crop of the indigenous people. In fact, they showed the pioneers how to locate and harvest groundnuts, and that helped them get through the first few winters in North America. This is a really easy plant to grow. It's a vine, so it'll climb up a trellis or a fence or other shrubs, and it'll spread in time. So if you plant them, it takes, a few years before you get a decent crop, but then every year after that you can harvest a bunch. And I just cut the tubers off the vine. They get to be about the size of a chicken egg, the large ones, and then I throw the small ones back, like I'm fishing, to regrow the next season. And they should be peeled. The skins are pretty bitter, but if they're peeled, they're very nice. If you cook them, you should cook them. But they're excellent cooked. I love them in soups and stews. A wonderful crop that you can have all winter. Hops, all the major hop growing regions of the world have taken to using the shoots of hops like asparagus. It's a very good spring green or spring purple, actually. They're purple and they're beautiful. They're quite hairy, so I don't like them raw. You can eat them raw, but I don't like the texture. But just a bit of cooking will mitigate that entirely. And then just a little butter, a little salt and pepper, a little hollandaise sauce, and bingo bango. It's really good. It's very delicious and easy to grow. Honwort and Mitsuba. These are the only two plants in their genus, Cryptotania. So I started growing Mitsuba because I was aware of that from the permaculture literature. But then Sam Thayer turned me on to Honwort, which is native. It grows better for me than Mitsuba. It's native to Ontario anyway, and some parts of the United States. And it does really well in the shade. So an excellent candidate for a forest garden. And these are delicious plants. You can eat them raw. It's known as Mitsuba is known as Japanese parsley, and they have sort of a parsley-esque flavor. If you cook them lightly, they make a really nice side dish and form a somewhat good ground cover as well. Hostas, this is one avenue that I sort of like persuade people or try to get people to try their hostas, because so many people have these in their gardens and either they didn't know they were edible or they figure, oh, it's just, and it's a novelty. The hostas are not a novelty. They are fantastic vegetables. It's one of my favorite crops. It's the shoots in the spring. So as the leaves emerge in the spring, they're these tightly curled spears, and you can cut them all off the plant, and it will grow more. So you just get one harvest off each plant, and they're really quite mild in flavor. I use a bucket to blanch mine quite often, and this makes them more tender. And it also means that you'll get a larger crop because they stretch for the light. So it's a really good technique to use with hostas. It also reminds you to check on them. If you have a bucket in your garden, it's sort of like looking at you as you walk past and saying like, oh, check to see where we are now. And then I use, I have so many hostas in my garden now that I can't eat them all at once. So I will cook them and then use a hand blender to blend them up into a hosta sauce, which I use with pasta. I'll use it as sort of a base for sag paneer. I also love them roasted. I just roast the shoots in the oven, a little olive oil, a little salt and pepper, and they're fantastic. I use them to make kimchi instead of cabbage. They're so mild, and they're a lot like cabbage actually in texture, and so they can be used in any number of different ways. So eat your hostas. Just try them if you have them. One other thing about hostas, they make a bomb-proof ground cover. This is why they're so popular in the plant industry. It's not only that they're beautiful, it's they're extremely low maintenance. You just stick it in the ground, walk away, and then come back to harvest. It's the like one of the easiest perennial vegetables to grow. Milkweed, this is a really important plant to grow just for the monarch butterflies, but we can share it with them because milkweed offers four different perennial vegetables. In the spring, there's shoots. The pods, when they're only about half size, so about 1.5 inches to 2 inches in length, and then the unopened flower buds. make a nice broccoli. And then the silk inside the mature pods can be used as sort of as a vegan cheese. You can use it on pizzas and such. All of these should be cooked for about 10 minutes to render them edible. But after that, they're excellent. There are about 5% of the population have a sensitivity to milkweed. So some people will throw up if they eat it. So if you try it, just try a little bit to see if your body can withstand it. But I've been eating it for years. I've served it to many, many people, and I've only had two who have had a bad reaction. So, you know, it's something that we should all be planting more of. The onion family offers a huge variety of different perennial edibles. These are Egyptian walking onions. They grow, instead of flowers, they grow little bulbs at the top of their stalks, which get bigger and bigger until the stalk falls over, and then they grow from there. So they're walking around your garden, and every part of the plant is edible. You can eat the underground bulbs, you can eat the greens in the spring as green onions, and then the bulbs at the top of the stalk, you can just pluck them off and chop them up and saute them like onions. A really easy to grow, versatile perennial onion. Garlic chives have been cultivated in China for hundreds, if not thousands of years. These are much milder than the European chives that you're used to. Really nice flavor. I throw them in salad sometimes, but lightly sauteed, they're excellent. You can also use the flowers in salads. Same with nodding onion. Nodding onion is native to Ontario and much of North America. These are beautiful, beautiful onions, often sold as ornamentals. You can eat the young greens. They're also mild in flavor, and the flowers are beautiful as flower decorations. You can also infuse vinegar with them. this is the Telsing leek, bred by Telsing Andrews in Ottawa. She's a permaculture plant breeder there. And there are a number of different perennial leeks. I don't plant annual leeks anymore because I have so much production from my perennial leeks. You just slice them off the ground and then the leek pops back up. So you get one harvest off each plant, but a lot of these will self-seed from bulbs. There's also Babington's leek, which is a very useful plant to have and really easy to grow. They take care of themselves and then you just go out and harvest. This is Welsh onion. Not actually from Wales. These have been cultivated in parts of Asia for centuries, and it's mainly for the greens, but you can also eat the underground bulbs. You can easily dig up a plant and divide it, replant half of it, and then eat the other half. Ostrich ferns. My nursery is called Fiddlehead Nursery, and it's named after the ostrich fern, which has, you know, fiddleheads are one of the only perennial vegetables that people recognize. And so it's also a whimsical name. So that's why I chose it as my nursery. It's also native, and it forms a great ground cover. A lot of people grow these in the understory of their gardens and don't make use of them. So like, why not harvest your fiddleheads? So to harvest them sustainably, you only take two or three or half or less of the fiddleheads off each plant because they won't be able to survive if you take them all. So you just have to be aware of that. But and you have to cook them for about 10 minutes to render them edible and safe to eat. But they're, you know, pretty common in grocery stores in the spring in North America. So why not grow them in your garden if you have a shady spot? I grow indicator plants in my garden to indicate when the wild plants are ready. So the plants that I find around me are ostrich ferns, wild leeks, wood nettle, stinging nettle, and common milkweed. All of these I have small patches in my gardens. So when they come up in the spring, when I see the wild leeks emerging in my forest garden, I head to the hills and harvest. I have acres where I can harvest from. That's another one where you can absolutely harvest sustainably and in fact increase your stock of wild leeks. Sam Thayer put out a video last year on how to increase the wild leek population in your woods. I have about 7 acres of hardwood bush and like a patch of about a meter square of wild leeks. And I've started to thin those out and then replant them along the pathways so that I have an ever increasing amount of wild leeks. So there's a lot of concern about over harvesting, but it's absolutely possible to harvest them in a sustainable way. Wood nettle, stinging nettle. These are stinging plants. I don't want a ton of them in my garden, but I want some to let me know when the wild ones are ready because they're excellent perennial vegetables. And then common milkweed too. There's large patches that I know where to go to when mine are coming up. Patience dock. This is the largest of the dock family. Many of you might be familiar with curly dock. It's used in similar ways. But patience dock is larger and it's more mild in flavor. So a very nice perennial spinach plant that you can use just as you would spinach. It also provides a broccoli. So this is an image of three different perennial broccolis that are all ready at the same time. So this is Good King Henry, Patience Dock, and Turkish Rocket. Pokeweed is another one that I sell through the nursery and people never buy because it's poisonous. This is the most popular poisonous plant, poisonous edible plant in North America. Pokeweed is a large plant. It's beautiful in the garden. Every part of it is toxic, but the shoots in the spring, if you boil them for 10 minutes and discard the water, then that renders them entirely edible. And you can then fry them with butter or just put them in a soup or whatever. And they're very delicious and really high in nutrients. So this is a very popular edible plant in North America. 50 years ago, 75 years ago, it was there was a small canning industry using pokeweed, so you could buy it in the supermarket. But for the indigenous people of North America, it's been a very popular spring green for many years. I love pokeweed, and people are terrified of edible or of poisonous plants, but they shouldn't be. They should be respectful of them. And you can teach any child that, you know, you shouldn't eat. The leaves of rhubarb are poisonous, but we're not afraid of it because we're familiar with it. It's just, you know, I would encourage people to think of familiarity rather than fear. Pokeweed, I love pokeweed. I serve it to everybody every spring. And it's a huge harvest that you get off each plant. It's a really large, like bigger than asparagus for each plant. So they're lovely, lovely spring shoots. Scorzonera, this is one that has been cultivated for centuries in Europe for the root. It's also known as black salsify. The roots are delicious, but each plant only has one taproot. So you kill the plant to harvest the root. However, it self-seeds. So you can eat the mom and let the babies live. And it's also really good for a leaf crop. So the leaves are very mild in flavor and you can chop them up and put them in a salad or cook them as you would spinach. And then the unopened flower buds make a fantastic vegetable as well. Sea kale, this is one that was popular in England 200 years ago. There was a real fad eating sea kale as a perennial vegetable. They would use clay pots to force the young shoots. And then, you know, they would cook them like asparagus. This is a beautiful plant, works beautifully in an ornamental garden. And it's in flavor, it's kind of like a love child between asparagus and cabbage. Skirret is a root vegetable that was popular in Roman times as well. It was the Emperor Tiberius's favorite vegetable. Skirret, you can eat the shoots of skirret as well as the roots. These are the roots of skirret. They're related to carrots. Each plant has a bunch of carrot-like roots. They're smaller than carrots. They're about the size of your fingers. And they're very nice. You can eat them raw. They're good raw. They're excellent roasted. Unfortunately, I've developed an allergy to skirret. I ate it for years with no ill effects, but now it causes a rash. I'm allergic to that and sunflower seeds. These are the only two foods I'm allergic to, which is really strange. I'm the perennial vegetable guy and I'm allergic to skirret. What the heck? Anyway, Solomon's seal. This is a beautiful perennial vegetable. It forms a really great ground cover. It's about 3 to 4 feet tall, these long arching stems with white flowers hanging beneath. It's beautiful and it's a really excellent asparagus-like vegetable. It's actually distantly related to asparagus. I like to blanch mine as well using forcing pots. If I don't force them, I like to cook them. They have a bit of a strange aftertaste that I'm not fond of when they're raw. But if you cook them, that eliminates that completely. But if you force them and they're white, so this is an image of both forced and unforced Solomon's seal, then the white ones are really good raw. It eliminates that aftertaste completely. And I love chopping them up and throwing them in salads. They have a wonderful texture, very juicy. And then The shoots on the left of this picture, no, I'm sorry, on the right of this picture are false Solomon seal, which is related and used in the same way. And these love the shade as well. They're excellent shade-loving perennials. Seedless sorrel, this is one of my favorite plants. I push this on everybody. Everybody who comes to my nursery, I'm like, try this leaf. People are amazed at the flavor of sorrel. It's very sour. I eat it every day. There are many different species of sorrel, and seedless sorrel is my favorite for a number of reasons. One is that it forms an excellent clumping ground cover. Ground covers can be thought of in two different ways: clumping ground covers and spreading ground covers. The clumping ones are fantastic because they never spread; they stay in place. They're very low maintenance, especially for small spaces. So I have a patch that is in my demonstration garden that I planted 13 years ago. I hardly ever have to weed this patch. I never have to water it. And it's edible throughout the growing season. These leaves stay tender from early spring till the first snowfall. It's incredible. So a very productive leafy vegetable that can be used raw. It's every salad I make has tons of sorrel in it. And then I make sorrel soup as well. This is an egg sandwich with sorrel in it, with a salad with sorrel. I have tons of it. So I cook it down and put it in ice cube trays and freeze it for the winter to use in smoothies and to make sorrel soup. So this is sorrel groundnut stew that I made last winter. Stinging nettle. Some people come to my nursery and they say, "Stinging nettle, why on earth would you grow that plant?" And then other people come and like, "Oh, stinging nettle, I've been looking for this for years." And so it's really, people have like very different reactions to stinging nettle, but it's the sting isn't that bad. The thought of the sting is worse than the sting itself. But I usually harvest with gloves. If I don't have gloves on, you can sort of run your fingers up the stem of the plant and harvest in that way to avoid the sting. And just like 1 minute of cooking will completely eliminate the sting. There's a theory out there that stinging nettle stings because it's so high in nutrients that every herbivore out there would be eating it down to the ground. So it has to protect itself. It's extremely nutrient dense and one of the most nutritious vegetables you can grow. So you can use it as spinach. You can dry it. Drying it eliminates the sting, and you can use it either for tea or in soups and stews in the winter. Turkish rocket. This is a brassica. Native to the former USSR. It's often foraged in parts of the former USSR, like Georgia, Azerbaijan, Turkish rocket. The young leaves are nice cooked. I don't like them raw, but the unopened flower buds, the little broccolis that come off of this, they are fantastic, like a broccoli rabe, like a spicy broccoli. They're really good, quite productive. And then even when the flowers open, you can still eat the clusters as you would broccoli. So quite a useful plant. Udo is a giant perennial vegetable native to Japan. This has been foraged for centuries in Japan and cultivated in Japan. They cultivate these in tunnels underneath Tokyo, where they grow these plants in pots. And in early spring, you can find these in farmers markets in Japan. So you cook the young stalks. These are much, much bigger than asparagus. Like a mature plant will get to be 9 feet tall. So they're huge perennial vegetables. You cook them lightly, just like 3 minutes, and then peel the stalk and then chop them up and have like traditionally just like a sauce of sesame oil and soy sauce with some sesame seeds thrown in. Really nice a dish. I love having these every spring. This is the shoots that I've blanched and then, yeah, cooking those. Wood nettle is related to stinging nettle. This is native to North America, and it's a nicer vegetable than stinging nettle. The shoots are more succulent. They're more substantial than the shoots of stinging nettle and equally nutritious. So there's acres of these down in the floodplains. If you can recognize wood nettle, go out and get some. Like it's great because when you harvest it, you're picking the shoots, and then the plants will bounce right back. So you can't over harvest this. It's a really great, worthwhile spring vegetable to know. They do sting. So I wear gloves to harvest them, but I harvest so much that I make a sauce out of it and throw it in yogurt containers in my freezer and have it all winter. So these are barbecued wood nettle shoots. Really good. This is just a variety. Oh, there's lovage is fantastic. The lovage leaf there. That's also the young leaves of horseradish are edible. They're spicy. They're not as spicy as the root. So these are some dishes. This is some ways that I sort of use perennial vegetables. And, you know, if I have a whole bunch of different perennial vegetables, I throw them into eggs and greens or make latkes from them. Another way, soups and stews. This is, you know, a really easy way to use a whole bunch of different weird and wonderful perennial vegetables all at once. Green sauce. I make a lot of green sauce from the various vegetables. Like I have too much food coming out of my garden all at once in the spring. It's kind of overwhelming. So I do like to make a whole bunch of green sauce to put away for the winter. And so I have, you know, I'm eating from my garden all winter. So I just use old yogurt containers, and then throw them, you know, put them in labels. I have a small chest freezer, and so I fill that up with green sauce to use all winter. Pizza, it's a great way to use perennial vegetables. Perennial salads, I always throw a bunch of flowers. You know, there's a whole bunch of plants with edible flowers, and like, why not throw them on your salads? The only reason we don't see flowers in the grocery stores is because they wilt too quickly for them to carry them, right? It's like it's just so easy to impress people with edible flowers, and they're also highly nutritious. So why not throw more edible flowers into our meals? Anise hyssop is a native mint family relative that doesn't spread underground. Bumblebees love this plant. A whole bunch of different pollinators love this plant. And the leaves taste like sweet licorice. If you like licorice, my goodness, start growing anise hyssop. I throw these in salads for sure. Any salad, I'll throw some leaves of this in. A little goes a long way too, because they're quite flavorful. And then I dry this for tea as well. The leaves of basswood, I'm really interested in tree-bearing perennial vegetables. Yeah, so the young leaves of basswood are excellent. The seeds can also be roasted and used as a chocolate substitute. My friend Ken Roth made us a chocolate cake once using basswood seeds. I'm gonna stop there. I see we're getting on to time. I'm sorry, I've sort of just like been rolling along here,
I
but
never want you to stop. I never want you to stop. It's so good. Thank you, man. Can you stop screen share? And then
Yeah.
if people have questions, please go ahead and put them in the chat. That was really energizing. And you know, I have a fair amount of perennial vegetables, but not nearly as many as you. And it just gets me excited for spring, like to see my Fuki come up and my Turkish rockets, and then plant a whole heck of a bunch more. So this is so good. Your enthusiasm is infectious. I want to come and walk around your garden and have you be like, try this, try that.
Please do. Everybody's welcome.
Question, are there any that you found that are deer resistant or some that are better than others, maybe?
You know, I have a couple of dogs that do a pretty good job of keeping deer away from my house. So I can't really answer that. Like my hosta shoots, I get to them before the deer do. Generally, most of these perennial vegetables, like the animals don't even really recognize them. I have a lot of rabbits on my property, and they don't seem to bother many of my perennials. So I'm it might be that I'm just lucky and the deer haven't really clued in to what's out there.
I
So
think hosta notoriously gets ate up by deer pretty quickly. There's a question here about different zones. Someone's in San Diego and they're like, I love the ones you're showing, but is there a book or a resource you would point them to find the different perennial vegetables that work in their zone?
So the one by Eric Tonsmeyer covers a range of different climate zones. So there's a lot that he writes about that I salivate over that I can't grow in my area. So that's a good one. Also, Martin Crawford in England has a milder climate than I do. So his book will also cover a whole bunch. It's just called How to Grow Perennial Vegetables.
Perfect. Braden asks, are there any lists of perennial vegetables with their annual productivity? So I'm thinking about, I think it's like some quantifying the productivity.
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't know of any lists offhand. In general, perennial vegetables are less productive than annual vegetables because annuals have been bred over the centuries to be highly productive, but they require a lot more maintenance, a lot more fertility, and it's easier to cultivate like a larger area with perennial vegetables and then get enough food through that.
Yeah, well, just on that question, since you have all this experience, if somebody was starting anew with perennial vegetables, how many of each variety would you suggest they start with and then determine whether they like them and then to grow them to more? Like, what's a good place to start?
Yeah, one or two of each
One
plant.
or
That's
two?
how I started getting, and then and then you can learn how to propagate them because that's huge. And so you want more diversity. So I would only get one or two of each plant and then learn how to propagate those.
Perfect. How do you attract customers to come to your site and buy plants?
That's a great question. I need to answer that myself.
You're
Yeah, I do. I do social media. I do Instagram and Facebook, and then a lot of it is word of mouth. I have a lot of repeat customers coming back. I have a table at the Guelph Organic Conference every year, and I do talks there as well. So yeah, people are generally. I hope that people spread the word on their own because I'm not great at marketing.
Yep, absolutely. It looks like Skeeter, you have your hand raised. You can hop on in if you want to, if that's you.
Yeah, just really quick on books. Stephen Barstow has a one called "Around the World in 80 Plants," and he's at the Arctic Circle in Norway. And so his stuff is really reliable for cold zones. So I really recommend that for the cold climate people is to look at Stephen Barstow's book. But the other two books Ben mentioned are both also there's those are the three main books.
I
Perfect.
agree. I love Stephen Barstow's book.
Yep. Thank you, Skeeter. Appreciate it. And guys, unless there's any final questions, let's let Ben get on with his day. What would be the place to point people to for all things Ben Caesar to come to your garden to buy your plants, that sort of thing?
I guess just Google Fiddlehead Nursery, and my website has profiles of all the plants that I talk about. And so, not only do I sell them, but I give lots of information about how to use them, how big they get, and what, the sun and shade requirements and all that stuff. So go to my website.
That's awesome. I really appreciate how much you shared how to use them, how to cook them, the best ways to cook them. That's often a stumbling point. It's like, cool, I grew it. Now what? So thank you so much, Ben. This was really energizing, really great information. Thanks everybody. Next up is Ken Asmos, and he'll be on in about 4 minutes. So we'll hop off and we'll hop on that Zoom link and I'll see y'all then. Thanks again, Ben. Have a good day. We'll see you soon.
Thank you. Take care.